Calling, White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker on the 1st of October, Thursday, getting the countdown for Halloween, one of my favorite holidays, a very pagan holiday, originally very white, and so I sort of like that kind of holiday, yeah. Well, anyhow, let's get to it. We got to get back to the good news of the Pessimist's Guide to History. Let's go back to 164 to 180 A.D. The Plague of Antonius, Roman legions returning from Syria. Here we go with Syria again. Brought back a plague, possibly smallpox or black plague. I wonder if that's going to happen again. That had begun in the eastern regions of the empire. In 164, the pestilence, which followed the prosperous reign of Roman Emperor Antoninus, quickly spread throughout the empire, depopulating whole cities. Now that's a real plague, depopulating whole cities. The U.S. Military machine is doing a good job of that too. And they didn't even need a virus. That's the army for you, always being blamed for bringing back strange diseases from foreign lands. Well, it's true, it's not being blamed for it. It happens, and it's happened down through history. Or things like the black, the flu epidemic of Europe after World War I. It wiped out millions of people, white people. You can look at it two ways, whether it cleaned up the gene pool or whether it was just a loss of a lot of good people. I don't know. 184 to 204 A.D., Yellow Turban Rebellion. During an epidemic in China, here we go, the traveling magician Chang Chuch reportedly healed many by giving them water over which he had said a magical incantation. Oh, yeah, we've always got those guys around. The apparent success of his remedy earned him hundreds of followers, and Chang Chuch decided to exploit his success by beginning a rebellion against the corrupt eunuchs who actually controlled the Han Dynasty government. The emperor ruled China at this time in name only. Chang Chuch assured his followers immortality on the battlefield by giving them potions, and in 184 he and his followers, all wearing yellow turbans, took up arms against the government. That's religion for you. It's always, usually at the bottom of a tremendous amount of bloodbaths. Chang Chuch himself was killed in 184 AD, but his revolt continued for years afterwards, thus setting in motion events that later led to the downfall of the Han Dynasty. To suppress the revolt, the ruling eunuchs were forced to form large armies at great expense to the government treasury. Some of the corrupt eunuchs took bribes from the rebels, causing a rift between the eunuchs and the military, and soon resulted in the massacre of the eunuchs. While the Yellow Turban Revolt was ended by 204 AD, anarchy reigned in the empire, and the ineffectual emperor became nothing more than a pawn in the hands of the power-hungry generals. Maybe we're looking at something like that to come along for China in this day and age. You never know. They're walking a tightrope in China, you know. The emperor finally abdicated in 221, ending the long reign of the Han Dynasty. Future dynasties continued to use the eunuchs as political advisors. Western governments of the period never required castration as a prerequisite for civil service. However, I think they should. How many of these rotten politicians you think would be around if they had to be castrated to gain office? Oh, yes, Mr. Bush, Jeb Bush. Let's start with him. I have a personal thing about these Bushes. And in 186 AD, massive volcano erupts in New Zealand. Taupo, a volcano in New Zealand, erupted explosively in 186 AD, blowing away four-fifths of its cone and leveling 6,000 square miles of the surrounding countryside. The eruption was possibly the most powerful in history. And that's the end of our reading from Pessimist Guide to History. So you see, between earthquakes and volcanoes, Mother Nature has been kicking our ass for a long time. When you get it, read it in perspective. Yeah. And she'll kick our ass again. In fact, there's a Mother Nature's hurricane moving through Bermuda right now as we speak, and the governor of New York is telling everybody to be cool, prepare, run down to the grocery store and take all the food off the shelves, and if they won't give you any more, riot. Yeah, that's what's going to happen. Of course, nobody ever, very few people actually store food for an emergency. They wait till the last minute, till the hurricane's almost on them, and then they run in and deplete the stores everywhere, you know, especially the liquor stores. Well, here's a, as W.C. Fields would call it, a guffaw this morning early from Germany. On October 3rd, 25 years ago, divided Germany was reunited. A year earlier, the wall had fallen, united under the Capitalistas. The children of the unit born in 1989 to 1990 are the first generation that grew up truly free, truly free, truly free. This is a recording with Angela Merkel telling them what to do, where to go to the bathroom, and to get up and go to work. And without walls, supposedly. Well, walls can be in your mind just as much as in reality, so forget that. But what about the walls in people's minds? Yeah. What makes this generation? See the answers to these questions and many more in our main topic, Generation 25, Children of German Unity. Well, I don't think there's that much unity, and there's going to be a lot less unity as time goes on, and as the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and the government kicks poor people out of their houses or out of their apartments or out of their alleys, out of their cardboard boxes to move Syrians and other Afghans and everybody else in. How's that going to work out? You know, every once in a while, even stupid politicians make a mistake and say the wrong things. Now, this is from the Israeli press during the most recent Republican presidential debate. Ann Coulter, who I can't stand, sent an obscene tweet about Jews. This guy writes, "First, my contempt is moral. Anti-Semitism is evil." No, anti-Semitism is an insurance and a defense against Jewish crimes. And there should be an anti-Semitic party like there used to be in Europe. Anyhow, for the sake of argument, let us stipulate that you are not an anti-Semite. In other words, she does like some of the Arabs. Being so stipulated, you're damn rude. Well, you have to be very, very rude to keep up with the Jews. One does not say fucking Jews. One does not say fucking blacks or fucking Latinos or even fucking relentlessly self-promoting Presbyterian white women from New Canaan. Well, I say it if I want to. I can say it every day. I go in the morning, brush my teeth, and say, fucking Jews, fucking Jews, fucking Jews, fucking Jews, and you Jews can not worry about it, okay? But also, Anne, it's really personal. When I was growing up in Toledo, the Jews are always from someplace else but the Holy Land. Toledo was a factory town, a magnet for immigrants. You deplore both foreign and from Kentucky. Well, there's a class thing going on, Mr. Sir. There is a class thing. It never ends. So it's within the Jewish group, too. I mean, how you treat poor Jews? Come on, middle class and rich Jews. How do you really treat poor Jews? We know that the last time I checked, 250,000 New York Jews were living in poverty. What's that all about? The Jewish kids were the only kids who considered it cool to be smart, and so did their parents. Well, let's see here. I got to change this a little bit here. Okay, just a minute here. I shouldn't do it this way. I should pause and then do it. So the guy says, "One night at the dinner table, when I was about 13, my stepfather called me a skinny little smart-ass show-off kike for asking what Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire was about. Of course, I was showing off. What it's about is self-evident." Well, yeah, the Jews screwed Rome, going crazy and coming up with this new religion called Christ Insanity. And that's what destroyed Rome. I was smugly savoring the fact that I was the only person in the family who knew the title and the author, if nothing else, of such a tome. How many people have you met that ever read The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbons? Yeah, most people don't read. You know, I don't read as much as I used to, but I do read. But I bet the conversation wouldn't have gone that way at my friend Barry Cantor's house, another kike. There would have been a discussion, perhaps with a tactful allusion, of how it was all the Christians' fault. Well, it was the Christian Jews' fault, yeah. Or at least somebody would have looked up Gibbon in the World Book Encyclopedia. The Cantors owned the complete set. I didn't catch it, but I'm sure that Ann Coulter probably did mea culpa and give some half-ass apology. But maybe not. Maybe not. I think I've ever seen anybody that said anything anti-Jewish that got away with not apologizing profusely. Well, here's a little bit more from the Holy Land and the non-Hebrews. I like to read their stuff. They come right out and tell a lot of stuff that's quite true. Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, recently published an entire book calling for the destruction of Israel. And, of course, Israel writes many books on the destruction of Iran. They forget to mention that. Ofra Ben-Gil argues that its release was timed to celebrate the nuclear deal, Iran's victory over the great Satan, the United States. I think that's an insult to Satan myself. And more specifically, the little Satan, Israel. I like that. That's pretty cool. Little Satan is Israel. Ben-Gil places this in the context of the millennia-old history of Persian-Jewish relations with its many ups and downs. Among all Muslim sects, the treatment of Jews was the worst under the Shiite rule, especially in Iran, the only place where the Shiism has been the religion of the state since the 16th century, and where Shiites came to represent 93% of the population, and they're a large percentage in Iraq, too. In Shiite Iran, the Jews were persecuted and had to wear a special badge on their clothing to distinguish them from the Muslims. Well, where did we read about that before? There were also occasions of massacres of Jews or forcible conversions to Islam. Oh, too bad. Nobody ever has any problems, just the Jews. Like, forget about the Armenian situation and what the Turks did to the Armenians. And that's not a real disaster. Only when a single Jew gets roughed up is it a disaster. While before the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the government of the Shah nourished the peripheral alliance with Israel. Well, that's what kept him in power. The current clerical regime has nourished new dreams of its destruction. As long as the clergy rules Iran, the prospects for its accepting the legitimacy of Israel are dim. You know, this recognizing legitimacy and all that is such a bunch of bullshit. It's unbelievable. I mean, Israel's there. They are an established state. And for the Khomeini, these guys to keep yapping, obviously, behind the scenes, of course they might want to destroy Israel because Israel's poised to use the United States to destroy them. Why would they want to destroy Israel? So it's all a game. Especially when you know Israel has had major arms deals with Israel, I mean with Iran before. Everybody keeps forgetting what was going on under the warmonger Reagan's rule. Yeah, check it out. Read your history. What was Israel doing? And I read that to you just the other day, that they were Israel was providing Iran arms just a few decades ago. All this kind of stuff reminds me of a Hollywood wrestling match. You know, before they have the fight, they go around, prance around, do all kinds of crazy things. And it's all a show. However, they got to watch out because sometimes the show goes just a little bit too far. I'll bet you didn't see this on regular TV. The Pope was busier than we thought. Pope Francis secretly met with Kentucky clerk Kim Davis, the great Christian who's been married 4 times and had all kinds of problems. The Pope reportedly met with born-again apostolic Christian, who has become a hero of the religious right, during his trip to Washington last week. That's very interesting. Well, despite the Pope's call for justice and mercy, Kelly Gissendaner, a female, was executed a couple of days ago, I think it was yesterday, despite papal appeal, an 11th-hour clemency bid. Yeah. But the clemency board rejected those appeals, and Gissendaner, who had studied theology during her prison years, was executed early Wednesday. Well, it is an interesting case because it was her boyfriend that did all the slicing and dicing. And she was just secondary to the actual physical murder. That seems a bit strange that he would get life in prison, the guy who actually did the slicing and dicing, and this gal get executed. That sometimes these courts do strange things. Well, I see Oklahoma's going to remove the Ten Commandments monument from the Capitol by October 12th. Well, they should replace it with Hammurabi's Code, which is far better than the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are so simplistic, they could be rendered down into about two or three commandments. But the Hammurabi Code was much better. The state Supreme Court ordered the monument removed because the state constitution bans the use of state property for the benefit of religion. I agree, it's time for the Christian Zionists and all these Christian fanatics to take a step back and for the governments of the states to put them back a little bit because they got too much power, tax-free, their preachers are living like kings, most of them, the successful ones. Well, wake up, all you multiculturalists. You're getting your way again. H&M is a big, huge retailer of clothes. And it's to finally have someone Muslim in a hijab cloak over her head representing the brand is amazing to show. It says the model, Maria Idrissi. Well, that just gives you an idea how many Muslims are inside this country because that kind of stuff doesn't happen until there's millions, millions, boys and girls. Well, I see an article here about the 8 books that have been banned around the world for upsetting the status quo. Yes, the Bible's full of violence and raunchy sex scenes, but that's not why it's been banned in many countries. Across Central Asia, publishing and importing and distributing religious literature is restricted to prevent extremism. In Malaysia, Malay language Bibles are prohibited outside the confines of churches to protect the national security. Well, I think they're pretty smart. In North Korea, possessing a Bible is illegal because, well, pretty much everything is banned there. Governments often monitor and restrict communities of believers they fear might challenge their rule. Well, remember Rome and why? One of the main reasons why it fell? These leaders around the world looking at that probably. They're all reading Gibbon's Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. They do so by cutting off access to holy scripture. Well, I don't think there's much holy about it. And outlawing proselytization. You almost have to with these Christians, man. I'll tell you, they'll come right up to your door and knock your door down. All while pretending to champion freedom of religion or belief in their constitutions. Well, anyhow. Lebanon banned the Dan Brown thriller 2004. Not for its lack of literary merit, but because Catholic leaders took issue with its fictional assertion that Christ wedded Mary Magdalene and fathered her child. Those things are difficult for us to accept, even if it's supposedly fiction, said the priest. Okay, here, let's see what else we got. Harry Potter's been banned. In 2002, the United Arab Emirates Ministry of Education and Youth went full Voldemort, banning the wizard from corrupting young minds. On the grounds that J.K. Rowling's tale ran contrary to Islamic values. Well, it probably does. Whatever their values are. Number 4 on the banned book list is the Muslim Holy Bible. Holy Book is banned and restricted in many of the same places and for many of the same reasons that limit the Bible's reach. In 2013, the Russian city of Novorossiysk banned a specific translation of the Quran for allegedly promoting extremism and inciting violence, a move that placed the text on a nationwide blacklist. Well, of course, you're going to find a lot of things in those holy books pushing for extremism and murder and genocide. Muhammad was a killer par excellence, and he had several wars and he murdered millions of people. Oh, but he was a man of God. Anyhow, it's banned, and offended Muslims should take some solace in Russia's commitment to equal opportunity discrimination. Also banned are the works of Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard, Turkish theologians Saad Nursi, several Catholics, Jehovah's Witness, and Falun Gong publications, and a diverse range of other extremist religious texts. I don't blame him for outlawing those books. I don't blame him because I don't think they do our race any good. However, in the long run of things, I don't think banning books does much good because they always get out there one way or another. 50 Shades of Grey has been banned. Ultimate Nanny State Malaysia isn't into the role play of BDSM. The country's home ministry banned the 50... Why don't they use the words on something like that? The country's home ministry banned the 50 Shades trilogy and the first film earlier this year on the grounds that they were likely to be prejudicial to morality, whatever that means. Well, I think you know what it means. Malaysia also banned Canadian author Irshad Manji Allah. Yeah, that, he's a Canadian. Are you kidding? He's not a real white Canadian, that's for sure. Liberty and Love is the name of the book. And for being contrary to Islamic principles, raiding a bookstore and confiscating copies began the ban before the ban was even set. Verse 6, the king never smiles. Where men are considered gods, governments and societies don't take kindly to their blasphemous portrayals. This unauthorized biography of Thailand's King Borubudurji, boy, I'll tell you, these names, I can't pronounce them, was banned before it could be published there in 2006. Thailand's increasingly strict laws shield and the defied monarch from criticism and his government from accountability. A 2011 biography of Mahatma Gandhi was banned in the Gujarat state for suggesting that he may have had a homosexual relationship, and a 1984 biography of Pakistan founder Muhammad al-Jinnah was banned for claiming he ate pork and drank alcohol, both forbidden in Islam. Well, in the Church of Creativity, alcohol and smoking and stuff like that, bad eating, are condemned and I guess considered some kind of a sin by Ben Klassen, my friend Ben Klassen. But he was a little bit hypocritical because I sat at the table several times in a pizza parlor. He was drinking wine and eating pizza. So all religious type leaders of whatever bent tend to be somewhat hypocritical. The seventh most important banned book is the Satanic Verses. Remember that when they were trying to hunt this guy down, the author, and Salman Rushdie, and kill him? Most novelists don't make it to four books. Most fourth novels don't ignite global outrage and inspire assassination attempts. Salman Rushdie accomplished both with the Satanic Verses. His 1988 novel partly inspired the Prophet Muhammad by the Prophet Muhammad. The blasphemous book was banned in India, burned in the UK, and led Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini to issue a fatwa calling for Rushdie's death. Threats of violence surrounding the controversy still plague Rushdie. In 2012, he pulled out of a speaking gig at the Jaipur Literary Festival amid renewed calls for his assassination. There you go. They'll probably get him sooner or later. Well, the eighth and final book that's been banned all over the place was Into the River. Ted Dawes' 2012 novel won critical acclaim and several young adult fiction awards, in New Zealand, back when it was still available in the bookstores. The country's Film and Literature Board of Review placed an interim ban on Into the River earlier this month after the conservative Christian group Family First called for a permanent age restriction to be placed on the novel, citing its sexually explicit content. Selling or supplying the book remains illegal until the age classification issue is resolved, a stalemate that's contributed to a spike in global interest. Censorship backfiring at its best. Yeah, that's true. When you ban something, if you want people to read it, ban it. Well, I'll tell you what, I got the problem here with my local paper that's banned me. People ask me all over town, when are you going to write more letters to the paper? I say, well, I'll write them, but they won't print them. And it pisses them off, but never to the point of storming the front doors of the newspaper. The greatest book banners are the prisons, prison wardens and so forth. They ban almost everything, especially if it's pro-white. It's almost impossible to get any pro-white information into the prison, or say it like it is, that's for sure. It's because most prisons are run by thugs that are much far worse than the prisoners themselves, and the guards too. Well, let's get back to Jack Nelson's Terror in the Night about the Ku Klux Klan in the South during the 50s, and we'll pick up where we left off about J.B. Stoner. My good buddy J.B. Stoner, who's now, of course, dead. While Stoner's anti-Semitic activities had caused relatively little concern among Meridian's Jews, he was the subject of a bulging dossier at the ADL headquarters in New York. He'd been a Ku Klux Klan organizer as a teenager, formed the Stoner Anti-Jewish Party at the age of 23, wrote and distributed a pamphlet declaring the satanic Jews must be put to death, and for more than two decades had been one of the nation's most notorious hate mongers. It's all in the way you look at it, buddy. Lawman tried repeatedly, but without success, to link Stoner to the 63 Birmingham church bombing that killed four black children. Not until 1980, when he was brought to trial in Alabama and convicted in the 1958 bombing of another black church in Birmingham, did Stoner finally go to prison. At his trial, where he was sentenced to 10 years, John Young, the prosecutor, characterized him as a professional hater, a cold-blooded bomber, and a bald-faced liar. Well, I know he wasn't a liar, that's for sure. He never lied to me, I'll tell you. If he didn't like you, he let you know it. I think that DA was probably the biggest liar, or U.S. attorney, the prosecutor. Rabbi Schlager's reaction was an exception to the indifference with which Meridian's Jews met Stoner's visit. He saw Stoner's appearance as a part of a larger pattern of growing intolerance. Yeah, there you go. He urged the congregation to organize for its own protection and to install a security system for the synagogue. Yeah, let's see here. Let me straighten something out here. In late May 1968, Binder was invited to speak at a Meridian B'nai B'rith meeting and used the occasion to deliver a warning. Quote, "Listen to your rabbi. Take him seriously. He knows what he's talking about. I know from my experiences in Jackson," unquote. Meridian's Jews tried to shrug it off, badgered by the rabbi, and the temple's board of trustees finally agreed to discuss hiring a guard. Of course, the biggest reason was the money, probably. Oh, I'm sure it was. "We don't want to spend that money for the Goyim guard. We don't want to spend the money for the electronic burglar alarm." But ultimately decided against even that precaution. Schlager was left to find what reassurance he could in a pledge from the chief of police. Quote, "We won't let the bastards bother you," Roy Gunn said. Now, Roy Gunn, of course, is a good little white Christian police chief that's going to protect all the little Jews. we won't put up with Klan violence, unquote. We can only have cop violence. In Knight Rider attack late on the night of May the 2nd, a machine gun was fired into the home of Flossie Lindsay, a black woman active in the NAACP who had employed by a Head Start program in the Sand Hill community of rural Rankin County just northeast of Jackson. Well, in many countries, the chief of police is, like in Mexico, are the targets. And so you would think that this vagabond white renegade police chief would have probably been a more logical target than shooting through some black woman's window. Mrs. Lindsay's 6-year-old niece, Betty Jean McKinn, was wounded in the leg by a bullet. Terrence, commuting in Danny Joe Hawkins' dark green Buick back and forth to the area from his mountain hideout, had struck once more. On May 26, 1968, a Sunday, several area churches observed a restoration day to raise funds for the rebuilding of 6 black churches that had been burned in Lauderdale County in the preceding months. The appeal had been organized by the Committee of Conscience. You see, at the heart of all of this bullshit of running to the aid and working against separation with the blacks is the Christian churches. And if you don't understand that, you better get it through your goddamn head. Christianity is a virus. It's an anti-white virus. Pseudo-Judaism. 2 evenings later, Rabbi Slager and his wife got home late from visiting a young couple who had just become engaged. The Slager children, Lenny, 11, Helene, 6, and Davita, 4, as well as Mrs. Slager's mother, Ida Barron, who was living with the Slagers, were all asleep. The rabbi and his wife were preparing to go to bed themselves when, about 12:15 a.m., a thunderous explosion in the distance shook the china in their kitchen closet. The synagogue was 3 miles from Slager's house, but from the moment he heard the sound, there was never any question in his mind that it was the temple. Quote, I knew it, they've blown up the synagogue, he cried. The Meridian Temple was a modern 3-building complex of glass, brick, and concrete block. The sanctuary stood at the center, joined by glassed-in walkways to a religious education building on one side and a recreation building on the other. It had been built 4 years earlier, the year after Slager came to Meridian, and was located on a sprawling wooded lot at the end of a dead-end street in fashionable Broadmoor area, in other words, the rich part of town. The nearest house was 150 yards away. A powerful bomb made of 15 sticks of dynamite had been placed on the concrete floor in an alcove at the front door of the religious education building. It had blown a hole in the roof, shredded the walls of the building, shattered the windows of the sanctuary, and rocked homes for blocks around. The thick glass wall panels of each of the education building's 11 classrooms were shattered. Chairs and tables from the 2 classrooms nearest the explosion were blown out of the building. The blast was so powerful it warped the foundation of the education building, left a gaping crater at the front entrance, and draped the tops of the 100-foot-high pine trees surrounding the synagogue with the tattered remains of curtains and drapes. Terrence and Danny Joe Hawkins had driven quietly into the sleeping neighborhood and crept across the broad lawn, carrying submachine guns along with explosives. To reach the front entrance of the education building, they had passed a memorial given to the temple the year before by a group of Meridian Christians. 6 large gas lights burned perpetually in the memory of 6 million Jews slaughtered in the Holocaust. The lights surrounded a stone tablet on which was engraved the question, Am I my brother's keepers? Christians, 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 Christian virus. Police Chief Roy Gunn was in the hospital with a recurrent hip problem. He was asleep when a telephone call from the desk sergeant at police headquarters woke him with the news that the synagogue had been dynamited. True to form, the chief flew into a rage. He instructed the sergeant to get the department's top officials to his room immediately. Loss of control is what's worrying this police chief. That's the main thing. Same way with J. Edgar Hoover. He was a control freak. He didn't care hardly anything about blacks, if any at all. He's a control freak. His FBI were being made look like fools, and that was his main problem with the Klan. To tell the truth, he probably would have not really raged that much if they got all the blacks. J. Edgar Hoover, of course, appeared to me to be racially mixed himself. And, of course, a homosexual. True to form, the chief flew into a rage. He instructed, as his lieutenants and an FBI agent filed in, Gunn was still barking orders on the phone. The agent, in a teletype message to Hoover, said the chief was visibly upset and highly emotional as a result of the bombing and ordered his staff to commence this date an around-the-clock close surveillance of principal Klansmen in Meridian. Their activities will be closely watched to create the opportunity for an immediate arrest for any local violence, regardless of how minor. Chief Gunn hoped to put constant pressure on suspects to ferret out any weak links on the hardcore Klansmen. Gunn's fury had a personal edge. The Meridian bombing was a territorial challenge. It made a mockery of his pledge to Rabbi Schlager that he would keep his people safe. If he could not protect the Jews, what about others? As Gunn knew, his own name headed the White Knight's hit list. Reverend Harold O'Chester, pastor of the Poplar Springs Baptist Church, was awakened by a telephone call from the police department. The desk sergeant thought the pastor, as chairman of the Committee of Conscience, would want to know about the bombing. O'Chester was an unabashed conservative and segregationist who had declared, "I do not preach any social form, I preach the Bible." But the racial violence sickened him. As pastor of Meridian's third largest Baptist church, he had announced, quote, "It's time to get rid of the Ku Klux Klan, because they're taking care of business too well." The National States Rights Party, Americans for Preservation of White Race, and all other love white people type organizations. Shortly after the call from the police notifying him of the bombing, the telephone rang again. This time it was the voice he did not recognize. "Do you know what happened?" "Yes." "You're next." Jewish leaders in Mississippi expressed outrage at the latest bombing of a synagogue and vowed to raise whatever amount of reward money it might take to bring the terrorists to justice. The attack on the temple prompted the state and local officials to issue statements of shock and outrage. How many times have we heard that in history? Shock, we're shocked and outraged. Similar to those expressed after the bombing of the Jackson Synagogue and Rabbi Nussbaum's house. Mississippi's new governor, John Bell Williams, accompanied by staff members and several reporters, flew to Meridian to inspect the damage and offer the state's full support in the investigation. Quote, "What kind of mind could get satisfaction from something like this?" Unquote. He asked, standing amid the bricks, broken glass, and rubble. Well, the U.S. government does it all the time. They've been doing it forever, invading countries, blowing the shit out of everything. And what kind of satisfaction do they get? Bragging rights, I guess. Though Williams had been silent while at least 200 black churches in Mississippi were bombed or burned during his time as congressman and then governor, he now declared that it defies the imagination of civilized people to understand a mind so depraved as to destroy any house of worship. Well, I'm not going to comment on that. Ignoring the fact that six black churches in the Meridian area alone had been burned since he had become governor 5 months earlier, the governor called the bombing of the temple the first terrorism at a house of worship during his administration. Well, that's, you can't do that. You can't blow up these places because that's where God lives. Yeah. The Meridian City Council labeled the bombing a cowardly assault. No, I think it's pretty brave to take the risk of doing that, knowing what the punishment would be if they get caught. Called the terrorist acts merely symptoms of a disease that plagues us all. Yeah, we're white people. We should be sorry we're white people. And to protect our culture, that's the ultimate crime. And urged citizens to cooperate in the investigation. County Sheriff Alton Allen, in a local television appeal, also urged public cooperation in the probe, saying, quote, "We cannot and we will not tolerate chaos and violence in this county," unquote. Well, it's interesting, but you have no control over it. It's not yours to say. It's the soldiers of the night that will decide. The Chamber of Commerce adopted a resolution calling on the majority to assist itself to do whatever may be necessary to apprehend and convict those who destroy places of worship. Well, I don't think that they should be any more protected than any place else. In fact, probably less, because they're tax-free. And paraphrasing Edmund Burke, it declared, oh God, I get sick of hearing this. Quote, "All that is necessary for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing," unquote. That's why we invaded and killed hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq and Afghanistan and Yemen and everywhere, you know. Good men are doing nothing. Even the Meridian Star, which had ignored most of the black church bombings, denounced the temple assault as disgraceful in a page one editorial headlined, "We are outraged." On the editorial page of the same issue, the Star denounced another outrage, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision striking down the freedom of choice plans that Mississippi officials had adopted to avoid desegregation. The local business, as far as I'm concerned, they get what they pay for. You know, when you make it illegal to separate or even segregate, well, then you're the criminal, not the people who resist you. The local business community was more responsive than its counterparts in Jackson had been to the bombing there. A group of businessmen now decided it was bad for business. No. That included Christians as well as Jews visiting the Meridian Star. And the FBI later sent a teletype to Washington saying that they had gone, quote, "to impress upon the editor the need for more favorable publicity in regard to law enforcement agencies and less favorable publicity for J.B. Stoner and the NSRP. Binder and other Jewish leaders in Jackson, wait a minute, after conferring with Moore, decided to make their own reward funds available for the Meridian investigation, since the bombing there appeared to be the work of the same hands. The Meridian Temple's Board of Trustees appointed Mayor Davidson chairman of the committee to raise reward money. Meridian and Jackson newspapers quoted him as saying that as much as $100,000 was being collected to pay informants. They love those informants. The ADL's A.I. Botnick, who had driven to Meridian as soon as he learned of the bombing, assured Jewish leaders that enough money would be raised to solve the case. He also told Chief Gunn and Meridian Mayor Al Key to call on him and the ADL for any assistance they might need in the investigation. In Jackson, Joe Harris Binder and George Mitchell, a Jackson businessman who was a state president of the B'nai B'rith, scoffed at Botnick's assurances about the reward money. They said most of the money was raised by Jewish leaders in Jackson, and neither Botnick nor the ADL had any role in raising it. Mitchell had led to a drive that netted about $45,000, mostly in donations of about $5,000 each from various B'nai B'rith chapters. Of course, don't forget, The B'nai B'rith is the Masonic, more secret part of the Jewish thing. The ADL is just a branch, an investigating branch. the right wing never really exposes that as much as they should. It's always just the ADL, the ADL, the ADL, but it's the benign breath is the monster behind the scenes. I attended a couple of their meetings. Most of the money went through benign breath, Harris said, because that's the way it was tax deductible. We got to have that tax deductible. All the ADL wanted was the glory. Botnick talked too much. We told him to get his ass out of Jackson and keep it out. But you couldn't insult Botnick. To some extent, they were selling Botnick short. Jewish leaders in Meridian felt his close working relationship with the FBI was helpful. And in Washington, the ADL kept the political pressure on the FBI to make sure agents in the field had whatever mandates and resources they needed for the investigation. Like most Southerners, Gunn had grown up an unquestioning believer in segregation. And like many Southern law enforcement officers of his time, his instinct was to rely on force or physical brutality when it came to dealing with blacks. In the early days of the civil wrongs movement, his sympathies often had been with the Klan. For years, Gunn's approach to racial justice was summed up by his famous dictum, quote, "The only thing we need to enforce the law around here is a bunch of burr-headed sticks," unquote. Gunn often called himself a graduate of the School of Hard Knocks. Born on July 1, 1904, Columbus Leroy Gunn quit school in the 11th grade and went to work as a laborer on the Gulf and Mobile and the Ohio Railroad to help provide for his family. He worked his way up to brakeman, but his railroading career was ended by an almost fatal accident. One day while riding on the outside of a moving train, he lost his grip and fell between the two cars. Only quick reflexes saved him from being crushed to death. He rolled himself into a ball as the train passed over him, but his left leg was mangled and he was left with a permanent limp. Gunn joined the Meridian Police Force as a motorcycle officer. With his impaired leg, he had trouble at first keeping his balance and frequently fell off. He took so many spills that he would joke that son of a bitch will throw me and then come back around the block and chase me, unquote. He was never seriously hurt, but one of the spills re-injured his leg and made it worse. Eventually, he joined the Detective Bureau. He spent 15 years there before being named Assistant Police Chief and finally, in 1965, taking over the department. An imposing figure, he stood just over 6 foot tall, weighed 240 pounds, and spoke in a loud voice that some called authoritative and others called authoritarian. His daughter Amelia said he was the kind of person that when he came into a room, you either liked him a lot or hated his guts, unquote. One who hated him, and the feeling was mutual, was Sam Keller, the assistant Police Chief Gunn beat out of the top post. Keller was a known Klan sympathizer whose brother Harold, a city fireman, was a Klan member. Another brother, Everett, was a Meridian policeman who was neither a Klansman nor a sympathizer, but because of Harold's Klan membership, Everett was turned down for police training at the FBI National Academy. Everett Keller admired Gunn despite his brother Sam's feud with the chief. "There was never a time I didn't respect Gunn," Everett Keller said. But for him, there was only one way to do things, and that was his way. He had guts, though, and if he told you to do something, he'd back you to the hilt. He was an egomaniac, and he had a strange religious bent. He could go from religion to vulgarity in a flash. Well, that's not uncommon for Christians. He would say, "I fought the good fight, and God damn it, I'm going to keep on doing it." Gunn considered himself the keeper of the morals of his men. More than once he found that an officer was having an affair with another officer's wife. He would call in both couples and counsel them. He disliked Everett Keller's brother Sam as much as his dubious morals as for his Klan ties. Sam moonlighted in the country music disc jockey business on a local radio station and was widely known as a ladies' man. Around the police station, they jokingly referred to him as Killer Keller because of the women he went out with and had been shot to death with his gun while he was in her apartment. Keller claimed the gun had gone off accidentally while she was sewing a tear in his uniform. He was never charged. Gunn was in the habit of going to bed early, usually by 8 o'clock. But frequently he would wake up after midnight and summon a patrol car, then dressed in his pajamas and bathrobe and slippers, he would have the patrolman drive him around town so he could check on officers working in the 11 to 7 shift. It was a way of making sure they did not shirk their duty. Whenever he found an officer missing from his assigned post, the chief assumed he had slipped away for a tryst, most likely to meet a waitress from one of the local cafes or truck stops. Quote, "He's just fooling around with that damn chili pepper dippers," unquote, Gunn would say. "You'd better watch out for those chili dippers," unquote, he lectured his men. "They love that uniform, and they'll stay after you, so don't let them lead you astray. Now don't go messing around on your wife." He's talking about Mexican women here. Gunn's moral concern extended beyond the police department and included what people saw in the movies. He shut down the Royal Theater when it attempted to show an R-rated film called Bloody Mama, based on the gangster exploits of Ma Barker and three of her four sons in the 20s and 30s. The Marquis let the Meridianites know. Chief Roy Gunn says Meridian can't see Bloody Mary, Bloody Mama. Gunn acknowledged that he had not seen the film, but he had been told it included one nude scene and two nudes from the waist up, and was vulgar and indecent. A court overturned the ban in the movie played to packed houses, but Gunn was proud of his stand and kept a clipping of the Meridian Star's article on the controversy in his scrapbook. The law to him was black and white, and he had no philosophy to him whatever, said Elsie Logan, a Meridian stockbroker who served Gunn on the board of stewards of the Hawkins Memorial Methodist Church. Gunn was chairman of the board. He never had any question about what he was doing. He was adamant about the righteousness and the rightness of his actions. He was absolutely sure that every word of the Bible was true. Gives you a little idea of the mentality of this guy. He never had any of the doubts about that some others had of us had. Gunn's certainty reinforced his legendary temper. Many recall the time the Atlas Roofing Company was embroiled in a labor dispute and a striker fired a shot that shattered the truck driver's windshield. The chief ordered so many officers into the three available patrol cars that they were virtually hanging out the windows, and they raced to the scene. Gunn rode shotgun in the lead car. When the car screeched to a halt at the roofing company, Gunn jumped out with a megaphone. He climbed on the hood of the second patrol car and held his arm to look at his watch and bellowed, quote, "All right, I'll give you just 5 minutes to get your asses out of here. You can leave two pickets, but they can't sit down. If you're not out in 5 minutes, your asses have had it." The crowd instantly dispersed, leaving two pickets standing alone holding signs. If they had not left, he would have shot them. "I have no question about that," said John Proctor, the resident FBI agent in charge of the Meridian office. Well, that's about it for today. We'll take you back to Mississippi at a later date. I hope you find this information interesting, because I'm sure that most of the younger people, that's anybody younger than me, don't know much about those times and don't know much about the people who sacrificed their freedom and their lives trying to fight this federal invasion of the South. I'll be back with you tomorrow on Freya's Day. In the meantime, 14:05. I have nothing to say. One more thing before I leave. There's a film called Days to Come. that's on Hulu on the internet or whatever, Days to Come, and it's a German film. And in fact, it's in the German language, but they have English in it. So anyhow, you can know what's going on. But it's about as this thing keeps unfolding, the way it's going, and with the U.S. and their buddies invading various countries, and there's a rise of a guerrilla force or political upheaval against the system. And to me it looks very revealing as the possible way it's going to go, and the way I've been predicting for a long time. So if you want to know what I'm thinking, you better watch that movie. Okay, later.
A fearless warrior who protects his people from monstrous giants. He was the idol of Vikings and barbarians in the darkest age ever known to man. But few know the reality behind his myth. He battled the ancient world's most colossal sea monster. And he was the last hope for Europe's pagans as they defied the armies of Christendom. Fact and fiction collide in the myth of the mighty Thor.